Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. Now imagine a world where materials can heal themselves and electronics are built to learn the way your brain does. It sounds like science fiction, but this world could soon be a reality if our guest this week has anything to do with it. That's right, I'm joined by Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the National University of Ireland, Galway. Jessamine studies neuromorphic nanomaterials and builds networks that have a memory and can change over time. As the founder of Bright Club in Ireland, she is also passionate about science communication and using comedy to talk about science. So I'm hoping we'll get some top tips later in the show. Welcome, Jessamine.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, we're delighted to have you. Now, I used quite a few big words in describing what you do. Could you just clarify for our listeners, what is a neuromorphic nanomaterial? I'm struggling to say it even.
So nanomaterials in general are any material that's very small that would have dimensions that are close to the size of an atom, but a few bigger than that. So what I find interesting about them is that they have very different properties than materials at the macro scale. Like everything works differently. But I'm specifically interested in making electronics out of them, electronic devices that either you can apply a voltage and get light out or get current. But what I found as I studied different types of materials throughout like my PhD and my postdoc is some materials would have a kind of innate memory to them. Like they remember either sort of different stimuli that they've been applied with or different measurements that have happened to them in the past. And you might think that this is not great, right? Because if you're trying to build a reliable computer, having something that depends on what's happened to it before isn't necessarily the best thing. But that's actually kind of how the brain works. You know, you'd have a lot of kind of initially random connections that then change and evolve over time so that like a pattern of connections that you use quite often would get easier and easier and easier to access and kind of lower resistance, making it easier to have like higher current spikes through it. And then stuff that isn't really used, brain just kind of throws it away. And nanomaterials have quite a similar sort of memory behavior. So there's this whole field called like neuromorphic device design or neuromorphic engineering, where you're just trying to emulate the brain in some way with devices. And it turns out that nanomaterials are a really great way to do that. So that's what I do.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so cool.
So exciting. I can't wait to find out more about it. But also in the studio, we have to introduce producer Miriam.
Hey.
This is going to be her last science mixtape
for a while. Yes, so sad.
She's going to soon be jetting off to work on her master's project in America. More on that later. But for now, Miriam, I believe you have our brain teaser.
Yes, I do. So hello, science mixers. Today's brain teaser is there is a device that can add, subtract, multiply, divide, do any mathematical problem, write in any language, find out any universal problem, tell you any secret, and solve all human questions. It was invented quite a long time ago, and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. It has a deleting device, and it's quite cheap. What am I? So I'll repeat that one more time. So it's a device that can add, subtract, multiply, divide, do any mathematical problem, write in any language, find out any universal problem, and tell you any secret, solve all your human questions. And it was invented quite a long time ago, small enough to fit in your pocket, and has a deleting device, and it's quite cheap. So what am I? So I'll tweet that out for you. Let us know what you think.
I'm stumped. Sounds like a calculator, but then it doesn't.
I like how it's any human question. None of these like robot or alien questions, just human questions.
Yes. And animals don't even have questions, right?
Or do they?
Jessamine, could you tell our listeners what they might need to take part in our interactive section today?
Well, actually, to take part in the interactive section, you wouldn't need anything in particular.
Great. Just your ears.
Your ears and your brain.
Fantastic. And it's your mixtape today. So what is your song, your first song, and why?
So the first song that I picked is a song by one of my favorite artists who has a lot of like very high concept albums, which are mostly about like if you were an android in the future and exploring themes around like civil rights and human rights and android rights. And she has a lot of really amazing songs that all have really amazing videos. So you should definitely look her up. But I wanted to start with a song that I find is really good to like listen to, you know, when you've had a long time in the lab and you're getting kind of like frustrated with things and maybe you just need to like pick yourself up a bit. So it's called Tightrope by Janelle Monáe.
I can't complain about it. I gotta keep my balance and just keep dancing on.
In 1833, Charles Babbage invented all the parts that are now used for a modern computer, but it was only 120 years later that the first modern computers were invented.
What's the difference between like the Babbage computer and the modern computer? What makes a modern computer?
Probably like the chip inside it. I don't know the actual answer.
Do you know, Jasmine?
I just know that the Babbage one is called the Difference Engine, which I think is a great name, but I don't really know much about it.
So with your neuromorphic nanomaterials, and you say that they experience things happening to them, it changes them. What particular materials are you looking at, and what exactly are the changes that they have to experience?
Yeah, so it depends a lot on the material, and I've looked at a few. Like you can have a kind of silver nanomaterials that are coated with a kind of polymer that can change, like degrade or break down. You can have oxide materials that...
What would degrade or break it down? Is it like
voltage or
having a current go through it?
Yeah, exactly. Or even just having like a voltage across it. But then also you can look at like oxide materials that would either have like vacancies within them that can move around and create these kind of conducting filaments that allow current to kind of find a path through the material, or that have kind of like mobile dopants that might cause one part of the material to have a different conductivity than another part. So there's a lot of different ways of basically using like voltage or also light in photosensitive materials to change the conductivity and to change how easy it is for current to pass through. And basically, like the materials that I look at would be sort of networks of these nanomaterials. So you'd have a lot of different current junctions that might initially have like a broad spectrum of different properties, but as you apply a voltage across them, you can kind of change how they connect to each other, so that over time it evolves into something different from what you had initially.
Can you control that change? Can you decide how you want it to evolve, or is it kind of random?
So that's I think the heart of the question right there. And there's some systems in which it's very controllable, and then there's other ones in which it's a bit more random. But I think the thing about nanomaterials in general, because they're very small and, you know, you'd have a kind of a finite number of atoms that you can really work with, a lot of times the properties of devices that use nanomaterials will end up being like stochastic. You know, they're kind of randomly determined. They'd be more determined by like probability, how they'll respond. So if you had 20 devices, you can say, okay, this many are going to react this way and some of them might not work.
But you wouldn't be able to say which ones will.
Exactly. And it's interesting because like a lot of times when computer science people hear that, they're like, oh, well, then it's useless. But again, that is actually how our brains work. Like you can have a kind of like local breakdown of some part of the brain and it'll kind of be able to reroute around it. Not so much predicting that exactly the same thing is going to happen in exactly the same way at exactly the same time, but that overall the system as a whole can kind of compensate for that kind of stuff. So it's really interesting. It's a super different way of thinking about computing. Like when you just get down to it, the kind of systems that we have underlying computers and mobile phones and supercomputers are all extremely different from like the best computer that we have, which is the brain. And that means that, you know, supercomputers can do these incredible number of computations per second that like the brain is completely incapable of matching, which is fine. You know, I don't need to be able to like simulate an internal combustion engine.
Yeah.
I'm okay with not doing that. But then if you try to figure out like how can I build a computer that can do things that we find quite easy, like pattern recognition, it's really hard. And part of that is because we've built a very structurally different computer. And also in terms of like the power consumption of the brain versus like a traditional computer, you know, supercomputers, but even like laptops and phones will like heat up a lot because there's a lot of wasted energy.
And you drain your whole battery like before the day is out.
Yeah. But then like the brain only actually runs on like 20 or 30 watts of power, which is like a bad light bulb.
No way.
So that manages to keep us like standing and breathing and talking and listening to the radio and like all this quite complicated stuff, which we can somehow do on very little power. But it's partly like the structure of the brain that makes it so power efficient. So like if we can build another type of electronics that mimics that structure, could you have much better power efficiency? That's one of the things that we're trying to figure out.
And is that kind of the ultimate idea, like the application of this field would be to create a brand new computing system?
Yeah, I think that's one of the potential applications. Like there's quite a few, and we'll kind of see over the next 10 or 15 years, like which ones bear out the best. But I think like looking at the power consumption, availability to kind of heal around different faults in the system, but also like, you know, I'm a physicist. My background is all in physics. And so when I first kind of got into this area, I was like, oh, cool. You know, building devices that work like the brain. I'm just going to do some reading, figure out how the brain works, and then I'll know how to design a cool device. oh my God, it's so complicated.
Just
like individual neurons and synapses are so complex. So I think you might also get some understanding in the other direction as well.
Yeah, by trying to build it, you might learn more about it.
Yeah.
I find it so fascinating how over time our metaphors for the brain have changed. So back in the 17th or 18th century, you talk about, you know, the cogs in your brain, or you still have that saying now, I can hear the cogs turning while you're thinking, because that was their most advanced kind of machinery. It was all wheels and cogs. And now we compare it to a computer, but it's still not quite right.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Like, we'll learn a lot and it might be quite different from what we expect to find going in. But that's one of the things that's exciting about science, right? You have expectations and hypotheses, but then when you actually start to like put stuff together, build things, test those hypotheses, you might find that things are completely different from how you expected. And actually, that's part of what's exciting about it.
Yeah, definitely. Perfect time to go to song number two.
Yes. Song number two is actually a song that I loved so much when I was in grad school, and I still love it quite a bit, from one of my favorite bands. I think it's good for expressing things. We'll see in a minute. So this is Hysteria by Muse.
Nanoelectronics can be exploited to create an adaptive material suitable for making artificial skin, transparent conductors, or neuromorphic electronics.
So, Jessamine, over to you. I have not much of an idea what we're doing in this section, but it's our interactive section.
Yes. So, as you mentioned, I run Bright Club in Ireland, which is a research comedy variety night. And one of the things that we do a lot is we work with researchers to try to get them to like think about their research in new ways, or have a more like kind of comedic approach to it. But one of the things that I think is really important in doing that is using improvisation techniques from improvisational theater, improv, which I find not only really helpful, but also super fun.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think is really important about improv is this kind of idea that we should try to turn off our inner critic some of the times, which I think is especially important for scientists, right? Like, we can get to a headspace where it's kind of all about knocking down other people's ideas, and it can get quite scary to like throw your own ideas out there and feel like people aren't going to judge you if they turn out to not be right. And like in research, you come up with a lot of ideas that don't end up being right. Like, that's how you find the ones that are interesting. So I wanted to do an improv thing with you guys.
Ooh.
So in Ireland, where I play this, we call it 10 things.
Okay.
And it's kind of a category game. So you might ask someone to just like name 10 things that you could find in your pocket, and you could just start listing out like actual stuff in your pocket, or you could start to say things that like maybe you don't have in your pocket, but the goal is just to get 10 things.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter how factually accurate they are, or like whether they're actually in your pockets right now. If you even have pockets, patriarchy. But, you know, and then the people who are not kind of on the spot coming up with the 10 things, just after each thing, they say yes.
Okay.
To be like, yes, that was correct. Great job. It doesn't matter what you said. It's great that you're just getting stuff out. Mm. Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
Do you guys want to start by asking me for 10 things?
Yeah, because I'm a little nervous. I'm not going to lie.
So give me any sort of a category and I'll count them as we go.
Can it be quite wacky?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay. Jessamine, I would like you to give us 10 things you can find on the moon.
Oh, footprints.
Yes.
Woo.
An American flag.
Absolutely.
Yes. Abandoned lunar landers.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Golf balls that no one bothered to pick up.
Yes.
The dark side of the moon.
Yes. Yes.
A lot of rocks.
Yes. Yes.
Space dust.
Definitely. Yes.
Aliens.
Oh, yeah.
The Titanic.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And my dad. 10 things.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So, like, obviously, some of those are more realistic than others. But the idea is just to, like, say things and to try to feel good about just coming up with stuff. And I think that this is, you know, it's a skill for like comedy and public speaking, but I think it's also a really good skill for scientists to just be able to like brainstorm and throw stuff out.
Yeah. And think outside the box a bit maybe. And,
yeah. And to recognize too that when you're coming up with stuff, you don't have to be in that kind of self-judgy place yet. Like later you might come back and say, okay, which of these things are reasonable?
Yeah. Like, not the Titanic.
Yeah, probably not. I think we'd be able to see it.
Yeah.
But, you know, but like, yeah, coming up with stuff. So does one of you want to try it?
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, great. So do you want to give me 10 things that you would find on a ship?
Okay, lifeboats.
Yes.
And life jackets.
Yes.
You'd probably find a bucket.
Yes.
And you'd find a captain to steer the ship.
Yes.
You'd find ropes, lots of ropes.
Yes.
You'd find some food, I hope.
Yes.
You'd find a wheel to steer the boat.
Yes.
You'd find a sail, maybe.
Yes.
And a motor, maybe.
Yes.
And you'd find some fairy dust.
Yes. Those were 10 things. Amazing.
But I love how you thought, like, really realistically, whereas you just said anything that you could have thought of, and then the last one was fairy dust.
Yeah.
So I was like, yes, you said something that wasn't like conventional.
I think the moon was kind of harder to be realistic about.
That's true. Yeah.
That's the thing. All of the things you can say are valid in that game, which is one of the things that's so much fun about it.
Yeah. All right, Miriam,
are you ready?
No.
Do you want to name 10 things that you might find at Wimbledon?
Tennis racket.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tennis ball.
Yeah.
Yes.
People playing tennis.
Yes.
The stadium that they play in. Strawberries and cream.
Yes.
My father.
Yes.
My brother.
Yes.
Yes.
Little children.
Yes.
Maybe a car.
Yes.
And a train.
Great. Those are 10 things.
That was harder than I thought it would be.
I like doing 10 because I feel like the first 5 are often quite easy.
Yeah,
and
then
at the end, you're just like, what's an object? Yeah. What's, I know words, just say them.
If you extended it to 20, like who knows what crazy stuff we'd be coming up with. But
it would be very surreal by the end. Just be like philosophy.
So you do that when you say you sort of train people. Who are you training? Other science communicators or people that want to take part in Bright Club? Or?
So it depends. A lot of other science communicators, but also one of the things that I love about Bright Club is that it's not discipline specific. So we would have scientists, social scientists,
actually,
people from the humanities.
I just realized not everyone listening might know what it is. Would you mind just giving a brief description of Bright Club?
Yeah. So Bright Club is a research comedy variety night, which was actually pioneered here in London by Steve Cross, I think in 2008.
An alumni of this show.
Yeah.
Oh,
he did it all on the Naked Mole Rat.
Well, yeah. And so the idea of Bright Club is to have academics giving 9 minutes of basically stand-up comedy about their research. And for a lot of academics, this is a bit scary. When they first think about it, people are very excited and like volunteer for it quite readily. And then they're like, oh God, what have I got myself into? So I think the training part of it is really important. And basically, like I was a postdoc in Ireland and then heard about it as a format and just like wrote to Steve and was like, can I please do that in Ireland? And he was like, sure, you know, here's my manual
so cool.
on how to get one started. And it was great because he's been very supportive of it. But now it's been running in Bright Club for like 3 years and it's supported by Science Foundation Ireland, which is amazing. But it is supposed to be interdisciplinary. So the training for it is really about getting people kind of outside of their shell a bit. I mean, everyone is an expert on their own research. So I think I tell people to like look for surprises, look for interesting stories. But I use a lot of improv as well in the training just because I know for me it's been so helpful. Like I kind of came in to improv and comedy as a scientist and a science communicator, but also who had like a lot of stage fright and was very much afraid of like messing up. When I first started doing science communication, I didn't want to do any like spoken or talks or anything like that because I had such bad stage fright around it. So I had a science blog. I really enjoyed that. I was doing a lot of like writing, but I didn't want to have to get up in front of people, which is very ironic considering that like I do so much of that now.
Yeah. I was going to say, how did you overcome that?
Improv.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like basically just improv. Like improv has all this stuff around how to come up with ideas on the spot, how to stop judging yourself for those ideas, how to build things with other people and be very positive.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very freeing to kind of realize, okay, if I can get up in front of people with literally nothing like planned, nothing written, and just come up with something and kind of be engaging and funny and supportive of my fellow players, then like if you get up and you have a script, like that's easy mode basically at that point. And I think it's really valuable, too, because there's so many parallels between comedy and science. Like, they're both creative. They're both about thinking outside the box, looking at things in unexpected ways. So I actually would really recommend any scientist and maybe any person to take an improv course, especially if you struggle with stage fright or, you know, public speaking anxiety, as I totally did. Yeah. And now I feel, you know, very freed by the whole process.
That's amazing. I watch people up there, those particularly stand-up comedians, and just having to be funny on the spot, you're just like, wow.
Yeah, how
but do you do you're that? Right, it's just about building that confidence and being comfortable to let yourself say silly things.
Yeah, and just practicing coming up with stuff and not being like, oh, that's not good enough. Just be like, it's great, you did it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can go into like group meetings and like throw out ideas for mysterious graph features and be like, yeah, you know, it doesn't, if what I'm saying is wrong, that's fine. Like, we're just throwing out ideas here. So I think there's a lot of like crossover between the two skill sets too.
I can't imagine doing that because I'm somebody that plans all the time.
Yeah, well, and I used to be more that way.
Yeah.
I think now, like, I've had moments where I'll kind of forget what I'm talking about, or it's one reason actually now why I don't like write out scripts for my talks anymore, because I feel like it just stresses me out. And then if I'm like, if I lose a word, then I'll be like, God, what was the next thing that I'm even supposed to say? And now I'd have a lot more like key points that I kind of improvise between, and it makes me more comfortable. And I think it also makes me a better speaker. So I think everyone has their kind of own method, and that's another thing too with the Bright Club training that I do, is I try not to be prescriptive, because everyone will have their own kind of comedic style. Everyone will have their own method of preparation that makes them feel comfortable and confident.
And it's about playing to your strengths and your personality.
Yeah, definitely. Different people have different strengths, and also just like different ways of interacting with the world, different ways of communicating things. And I think it's always the most effective if you're kind of true to yourself. And especially in terms of like comedy or communication, like people can sense if you're like kind of putting on a front that isn't really you. They may not actively notice that that's what they're sensing, but they won't respond as well. So it's better to just go with what feels right to you.
Absolutely. We must fit the music in. I could talk about this all day, but what is song number three?
Song number three, again, I'm feeling like all of my songs are like pump up songs, but song number three is another, like, I think very inspiring and encouraging song at some of those times when you might need it. It's called Overcome by Laura Mvula. Take your broken wings and fly. When your head is heavy, Lord, Lord. And the tears, they keep falling. Take your broken feet and run.
In 1980, the first 1 gigabyte disk drive was released in the world. It was a whopping $40,000 and weighed almost 227 kilograms.
That's crazy when we think about the microchips in our phones now, how small those SIM cards can be. Wow.
Yeah. I actually really love reading old sci-fi, because if it was before the like silicon transistor age, it'll be like, oh, and there was a supercomputer and it was in a big cave underground.
It's taking up a whole room.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to your research and the kind of nitty gritty of it. So when you talk about building these or having these networks, how do you create them? Are you there like moving tiny, tiny wires, or what happens?
So that would be one way to do it, which sounds very labor intensive. So it's not the way that I'm doing. I'm quite lazy as a researcher. The nanomaterials that I work with are like colloidal, which means basically they've been chemically synthesized and they might be suspended in some sort of a solution, like in water or isopropanol. And then they can be like deposited onto a surface. So either spray deposited, or you can just kind of like put down a drop of one kind of nanomaterial. But basically, like, I'm not precisely placing any specific individual nanomaterials. And then I would have like electrodes that I'm using to apply a voltage and measure a current out. There's a lot of really, really good device work that is done using like specifically contacted nanomaterials. And it's really interesting. Like, from a physics perspective, there's so much cool stuff there. But it's like, as someone who spent a lot of time doing device design and lithography, oh my God, it's like soul crushing to just spend weeks making these different devices and just have like none of them work. Or like, oh, you were trying to like align your electrodes to like this one nanowire, and then they keep coming out like, you know, 20 nanometers shifted to one side, and that means there's no contact, and you just like throw that thing away. Like, it's very sad. I also think, though, like, I am interested in science and technology in a way that can actually be applied and maybe go into industry and change people's lives. And from an industry perspective, it's also very hard to justify, like, oh, I've made this incredible device. It does all these amazing things. Great. Like, how did you make it? Oh, I spent 4 weeks in a clean room. Like, industry doesn't care at that point. They've walked away. They don't need to hear any more about it.
Yeah, they're never going to make any money if it takes 4 weeks.
Yeah, or even if it's a very fast process, but, like, the yield is very low, like, 95% of the devices are garbage, then, again, not worth it from the industry perspective. So, like, to me, if you want to do kind of device design and build something that's actually going to be useful to society as a whole, you have to kind of think about those things as well. So from that perspective too, like, just nanomaterials that you can drop down onto a surface and then very easily contact and kind of try to use the, you know, stochastic nature of it to get something interesting rather than having to very precisely contact things.
So what do you find most challenging about this work?
Well, I think that's a good question. One of the things that can be challenging, as I said, is kind of the fabrication. Like, to me, once you've gotten to the point where you've actually made a device and you're doing electrical measurements, like, that's really exciting. And it feels like science in a way. If you're, like, in the clean room or in, you know, some place just trying to, like, make devices and they keep not working or something's going wrong, like, if you don't get to the point of even making electrical measurements, at least for, like, the stuff that I like to do, it just feels like, oh, I haven't even done anything. Even though, of course, like, the device design is a huge part of it, it's just, it's very challenging to even get something that kind of works a little bit the first time. I think the other thing too, though, and one of the reasons, paradoxically, why I got interested in this as a field, but, like, the science and the physics of it are just so different from what we might expect from the same materials in bulk. Like, if you have a just big piece of silicon, the physics around how that works and how it'll behave when you apply a voltage to it are very, very well understood. But then when you start scaling down and when you get below something called, like, the quantum confinement regime, you'll start to just get very different physics because now you're starting to have to take quantum effects into account. And to me, that's what really defines what is or isn't nanoscience. Like, when you get to the point where there's new science that we don't see in our kind of bulk macro scale world, that's nanoscience, and it's exciting, but it's also confusing and weird. Because a lot of times you'll be like, oh, I've made this thing, I think it's going to do this, and then, like, a third random thing comes out, and you're just like, what? Yeah. What am I supposed to make of this?
Yeah, it doesn't, like, work with, like, our normal laws and stuff, does it?
Yeah, and, like, and as well, you know, there's what I was saying before about, you know, we have to be creative and we have to, like, think outside the box to, like, solve things or be able to explain why some data come up even when we don't expect them. But it's also very frustrating, you know, when you're, like, a scientist and you're like, I need to get some papers, or, like, I'm never going to graduate, or my boss is going to be mad at me, or, you know, my university's going to be mad at me if I'm the boss. Like, it's very hard in those moments to be like, no, remember, you're doing this because you don't know what the answer is. Like, if you knew what the answer was, it wouldn't be research science.
Yeah.
It might be easier, but it wouldn't be research science.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you, so in the introduction, we talked about materials that heal themselves. Have you made one that heals itself?
Yes, in a manner of speaking.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because it's basically, like, on an electrical level, what would it mean to heal yourself? It's kind of being able to route around a place where the conductivity paths have kind of been broken. So does the material have a way to set up new conductivity paths through it? And that's, to me, what's really cool about these kind of networks of nanomaterials, is that you're not just relying on, like, one kind of feed through or one switch that always has to work in order for the device as a whole to work. You might have a lot of other options. And maybe the first connectivity path that got set up was, like, the most low energy, or, you know, the easiest one to do because nature does things that are easy. But if that is broken somehow, and that happens quite a lot, I think as a nanoscientist, I have caused a very many tiny, tiny explosions, melting things, and, like, something doesn't work. And then I go to, like, electron microscopy and I'm like, oh, I see, it's all exploded. Okay, that's fine. But being able to route around those and just, like, go through other nanomaterials that are in the same film is super important. And similarly, you know, like, in the brain, if you had, like, a connection that you were using quite a bit and then something happened to it for whatever reason, the ability to kind of go around that and establish new connections, which neuroscientists would call, you know, neuroplasticity, which is actually also still a very active field, like, that's only started to be well understood in the last few years, because for a long time people thought, okay, you know, once you're an adult, your neural connections can't change.
And now we think your brain is developing until you're 25.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that you can kind of retrain the brain, it gets harder as you get older, but there do seem to be some parts of the brain that continue to grow new neurons and where you can retrain existing neurons into new kind of pathways. That's super interesting. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, can we mimic that in an inorganic device? And then what does that tell us about the kind of organic computer that we all have as well?
That's incredible. What is song number four?
Song number four is actually one of my favorite, like, pre-Bright Club or pre-show songs. I really, really enjoy it, and it's by this American singer who I think is great overall. So this is The Real Thing by Toon Yards. My lungs, soft and loud anyway, feels good.
Key advantages of neuromorphic computing compared to traditional approaches are energy efficiency, execution speed, robustness against local failures, and the ability to learn.
Science.
News.
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 News just in. Nanobot viruses tag and round up bacteria in food and water.
Is there life on Enceladus?
Where did insect wings evolve from?
Live heart cells make a color-changing material similar to chameleon skin.
Scientists have discovered the largest organ in the body, and we never knew it was there before.
What is this new organ that none of us have heard of?
It's called the interstitium. And okay. Yeah, so it's a really interesting story because basically researchers in the New York University School of Medicine basically were finding that there was stuff that they were imaging using this new technique that didn't correspond to any structures that people knew about in the body so far. And what they think is there and what they're calling the interstitium, which they say is the largest organ in the body, are these interconnected fluid-filled spaces that are basically supported by bundles of collagen. And they're throughout a lot of the major organs in the body. They're throughout the kind of connective tissue as well. And the reason why no one had seen them before was that traditional kind of biological sample preparation to put tissue on a slide involves a process that empties out these kind of cavities, and so they just collapse. So all of the techniques used to look at tissue were just totally missing these.
I guess you always think of an organ as like one object, but I think the technical definition is just a group of tissues that work together to provide a function, right?
Yeah, like I always heard that the skin was the largest organ, which is kind of like, what? Skin's not a... Well, is it?
Okay. And blood is an organ.
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. Yeah, so I think if it, yeah, as you're saying, a collection of tissues that perform some function together and are in some way self-contained. But so these kind of interstitium spaces are thought to be throughout a lot of the body. And what these researchers who have identified them are wondering is, can they be used to explain some of the body's response to disease or even potentially some unanswered scientific questions like acupuncture? Why does acupuncture seem to work, but also we can't really explain why it would work? And one thing that they propose for the interstitium is maybe that's what it is affecting. There were a couple other researchers who had written papers that kind of implied the existence of the interstitium in the last 5 years or so. And so these guys from NYU have kind of built on that. And I think it's going to become a very active research area to try to understand this better, because it's something that was kind of under our noses the whole time. But only now are we really seeing what's there.
I love it. I would never have thought we'd find something so big and so new in the body. So my story about the nanobot viruses, I think this is really exciting. So basically, they've taken these viruses called bacteriophages. So they don't really attack our cells, that they burrow into bacteria cells, quite specific. Different phages will attack different types of bacteria. And they've attached different nanomaterials to them, like tiny particles of gold and stuff. And they've also meddled with their bacteriophage's DNA. So when the bacteriophage attacks a bacteria, it injects its DNA into it
to be replicated, as all viruses. And so the bit of DNA they've added means that it tells the bacteria to make a particular enzyme, which will then change colour. So if you put all these phages in some milk and the milk has E. coli, the milk might go pink, and then you know that it's gone off. Mm. And then the other thing that they can do is, because they've got these little particles of gold, they can use a magnet to like swirl that magnet through the milk, and it will collect all the E. coli. And they were able to pick up like 10 E. coli in half a cup, so tiny, tiny amounts. And normally you'd only be able to tell if E. coli were in there by growing it for a couple of days until the amounts were big enough. So it makes it really quick to screen your food, your water. And yeah, I just think it sounds like a really fascinating new area of science.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Miriam.
All right, so I'm going to talk about Enceladus. So Enceladus is one of Saturn's moons, and it's one of the prime candidates to host life. So it's special because it has an ocean of liquid, salty water underneath its crust, which is made of solid ice. And often there's like atmospheric plumes of water, which are seen to shoot out icy particles at about 800 miles per hour. And Enceladus is about 500 kilometers in diameter, so it fit nicely in the state of Arizona in the US. And its atmosphere consists of gases such as hydrogen, carbon dioxide, and tiny amounts of methane. Now, methane is the gas that scientists are a bit kind of puzzled upon, because they know that there's these microbes which actually produce methane as a waste product, and they want to find out whether Enceladus actually has life. Like, where is this methane coming from? So what Simon Rittmann from the University of Vienna in Austria and his team actually exposed these microbes to conditions which mimicked the atmosphere of Enceladus, and they did find that the bacteria did produce methane. So they're starting to think maybe these microbes actually exist on Enceladus. So obviously we can't say that now, but this is a step in the right direction to saying maybe there is life on Enceladus, which is amazing.
And so much closer than anyone thought it would be.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really cool. God, our sun is just doing a great job with it. It's life-giving. Jasmine, tell me about your other story.
Yeah, so the other story that I wanted to talk about is basically researchers who are trying to understand how insect wings evolved. Now, insects basically could fly before anything else could on Earth, about 300 to 360 million years ago. But it's still not really clear, you know, how insects first would have evolved wings. And there were a few kind of competing hypotheses, one which was that basically something on the backs of insects might have kind of developed maybe into first something like a membrane that then could have eventually turned into something that could give flight. But would have had to have some sort of benefit before that point, even for it to be selected for. And then that was called the Turgle hypothesis. There's also the Plural hypothesis, which is that maybe, you know, because most insect wings are articulated in some way, like they wouldn't just be membranes, but they'd have some sort of parts that can be independently moved. Mm. So what else is like that? Legs. So I thought, well, maybe wings just started as kind of messed up weird legs, but those are on the bottom of the body for most insects. So they would have had to kind of migrate up to the back of the insect somehow. So there was two competing hypotheses, and researchers in the Tomoyasu lab in Miami University in the United States basically used genetic manipulation to study these flower beetles to try to figure out, can we induce them to evolve
legs
some
on their back?
Yeah, well, or membranes or something, because they're not very good at flying at all. You know, obviously it wouldn't have been useful to study an insect that can already fly. So they did some kind of different types of gene editing and basically were able to create tiny wings or kind of wing nubs, both on the front, on kind of the bottom of the insect, and also on its back. Right. But they basically both popped up from the same genetic manipulation. So it's very interesting because the genes that they thought might control this actually seemed to control both of the kind of positions where they thought that wings might come up. And there was this kind of third hypothesis, the dual origin hypothesis for wing development in insects, which kind of said, well, maybe they both are necessary. Like, maybe you need both the membranes and the articulation in order to get a final wing. But it didn't make a lot of sense initially because, well, they're on opposite sides of the body. But what these researchers have showed is that it seems to be controlled by the same genes. So maybe that is where it came from. Maybe you do kind of get both things starting out and then kind of coming together, both the membranes and the articulation, in order to create insect wings. Okay. It's very cool.
That's so interesting that they're able to kind of back engineer that as well.
Yeah.
Pun not intended.
Hey-o.
Very briefly, my news story was that, my second story even, I had no idea chameleons can change the color of their skin because the skin, the color changes when it's stretched or not stretched. They've recreated this with some heart cells and another chemical in a material. And when the material's stretched, the heart cells are one color, and when they're not stretched, it's another color. And that was it.
Amazing.
And now, Miriam, tell us a little bit about what you are going to be doing in America, because this is the science news for science mixtape. Yeah.
So really, really soon, I'm going to be jetting off to California, sunny California. I can't wait because we've had a lot of rain in London, so I miss the sun. But I'm going to the SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory. So that's home to the longest linear particle accelerator in the world. But I won't be using that linear accelerator, but instead I'll be using the kind of X-ray laser that's attached onto the end of that. And what my master's project will be doing is kind of using, I have to build a system that will tell me information about laser pulses. So I'm going to be given like a laser, and I need to tell the scientists there what their laser, like the characteristics and the profiles of that laser beam. So that's what I'll be doing for the next kind of 6 to 7 months. But I'm super excited to work with basically researchers in a national lab, because I did go there 2 years ago, but now it will be my independent project where I get to be flexible on what I do out there. So I can't wait.
So exciting. We're going to miss you.
Thank you.
Stay in touch.
I will.
And what is your fifth song, Jessamine?
So my fifth song is one that I'm a really big fan of, but it's also kind of related to why I'm here in London at the moment. So I am over because I just saw Hamilton. I'm
so jealous.
Delighted. Oh my God. It was amazing. This is the longest that I've ever planned for anything. And if you don't know Hamilton, it's like a kind of hip-hop musical about the founding of the United States. And the creator of Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda, put out this kind of mixtape of lines from the show that had been kind of remixed with different artists to create songs that were kind of about some of the topics of the show, but they weren't in the show itself. And there's like a really famous line from the show, "Immigrants, we get the job done," which I love, both in like the context of like, what makes America great? Immigrants. But also now I too am an immigrant and have gone out of my country to another country. And, you know, all of the increasing restrictions on immigration in both like the US, UK, lots of places. So this song is called "Immigrants, We Get the Job Done." It's from the Hamilton mixtape, and it features Kanan, Snow the Product, Riz MC, Residente, Riz Ahmed. And I think you'll really enjoy it.
Yet. I got one job, two job, three when I need them. I got five roommates in this one studio, but I never really see them. And we all came America trying to get a lap dance from Lady Freedom. But now Lady Liberty is acting like Hillary Banks with a prenup.
Banks with a prenup.
Man, I was brave, sailing on graves. Don't think I didn't notice those tombstones disguised as waves. I'm no dummy. Here's something funny. You could be an immigrant without risking your lives or crossing these borders with thrifty supplies. All you gotta do is see the world with new eyes.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come.
We get the job done.
Look how far I come. Look how far I come. Look how far I come.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
By electrically stressing networks of nanomaterials, scientists can tune them to create electronic materials that learn from their history.
You know, one thing I really love about that song as well is I feel like science runs on immigration in a way. You know, like so many Nobel Prize winners were immigrants. So many people move around to do their PhD or their postdoc or things like that. Like a lot of science really depends on the mobility of people and on being willing to accept people from other places.
So true. I mean, Einstein was an immigrant to America, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Mm, yeah. We were very glad to have him.
What is coming up next for you in the future?
Well, one thing that I'm working on putting together now that I'm really excited about is this nanoscience and dance piece, which is going to be happening in the fall in Galway. And it came from this science art residency that I did last summer. I went to the Arctic Circle on a tall ship.
Amazing.
Yeah, with a bunch of scientists and artists. And basically, we were on the ship. It was very cramped quarters, as you can imagine. So we all had bunkmates. And my bunkmate was this choreographer from Southern California who's done all this interdisciplinary, like, choreography and history or, like, band books or, like, you know, choreography plus atomic line spectra or particle wave duality. And so we're basically going to be working together to develop this show. She's on sabbatical and she's going to be up in Galway with me in the fall. And we're hoping to put on a show for Science Week that's going to be like
so cool.
Dance and exploration of physical concepts relating to nanoscience, which I'm really excited about.
Oh, amazing. I love getting like art and science collaborations because, like you said, science is so creative and it's great to express it in ways that aren't kind of like written down. It's great to explore other ways to express it.
Yeah, absolutely. And to kind of like to recognize that there are different ways of thinking about things as well. So we might have like a verbal way or a mathematical way of thinking about science, but also, how can we express that through
physical
music or, you know, visual art or choreography and dance?
Oh, I'd love to ask you more about your Arctic trip, but sadly we've come to the end of our show. Miriam, could you please put us out of our misery and tell us the answer to this brain teaser?
Okay, so I'll remind you what the brain teaser was. So I said that there is a device that can add, subtract, multiply, divide, do any mathematical problem, write in any language, find out any universal problem, tell you any secret, and so solve all of your human questions. It was invented quite a long time ago. It's small enough to fit in your pocket and it has a deleting device and it's quite cheap. What am I? So it was in fact a pencil. Because you can just write about anything and the deleting device was the eraser on the top of the pencil.
Oh, I love that. Because obviously it sounds like a computer.
Yeah, exactly.
But that wouldn't fit in your pocket.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Jasmine, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. It's amazing listening to what you do. I'm inspired.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
And what is your final song to play out on?
My final song is my like recent obsession. So this is again a kind of like pumping up song that's about not only like pumping yourself up, but also like the people that support you, you know, your friends, your lab mates, everybody. So this last song is called Squad by Nadia Rose.
Guess who, man? What? But you never left. Yes, I did, I rose from the dead. And now I'm here to kill them with flows and some punch lines that will go
over your head.
Turn back. Caution ahead, I'm your worst nightmare, stood over your bed. So them girl try corny, but I smell defeat like a hole in your crab. Wow, she's sick and she's bad, she sings and she raps, she shit and she's wild. They talk all that chat, but when they see me, don't speak none of that. Cause nobody bad like me, I'm fucking higher than a block of flats and batter, see, whoa. And I'm with my team, Squale, Squale, where you at my G's? I'm rolling 10, yeah, up on that squad. That's what?
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider.